This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast. Support comes from the fully employed MBA program at Pepperdine University's Grazia Deo School of Business and Management. For information, log on to bschool.pepperdine.edu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, the big four record labels are finally offering some music free of copyright protection. Is it too little too late to save the industry as we know it? Then, does no Golden Globes plus no Oscars equal no box office? And finally, swag, Hollywood's silent scourge. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. Finally, we saw a turning point in the high-def DVD war between Sony's Blu-ray and Toshiba's HD DVD. Toshiba got cold-cocked by Warner Brothers at the giant Las Vegas Consumer Electronics Show last week. Hollywood's largest studio announced that it will only release their movies on Sony's rival format, Blu-ray. It could be a knockout punch. Other studios, like Paramount in the HD DVD camp, will probably now defect to Blu-ray as well, dooming the HD DVD format once and forever. Of course, none of this may matter in a year's time anyway, because at the very same Consumer Electronics Show, Netflix announced that it was partnering with LG Electronics to develop a magical box, one that will stream movies from the internet to high-def TVs. The Netflix LG box would eliminate the need for DVDs altogether, high-definition or otherwise. In music news, Taylor Hicks may have won American Idol in 2006, but today he's just another schlepper jonesing for a record deal. Hicks was dropped last week by J Records, one of the Sony BMG labels which signed the show's singers. Also parting company with Sony's RCA label last week, Catherine McPhee, the 2006 Idol runner-up. Her only album debuted at number 2 on the Billboard 200, but the album sold poorly in the U.S. In related Idol chatter, the Chinese government has clamped down on American Idol-style shows, like Mongolian Cow Sour Yogurt Super Girls Contest. And no, we're not making that title up. Supergirls was a singing competition where viewers voted by mobile phone, text message, and the internet. The show attracted more than 120,000 young female contestants and, more to the point, millions of voters. While the communist government wound up squashing Supergirls, they're now all for a new, officially licensed Chinese version of America's Next Top Model, which starts next week. You see, unlike the Supergirls competition, Top Model has a politburo, panel, of officially sanctioned judges. It seems the people who brought you Tiananmen Square don't have a problem with cheesecake, but rather, Democratic-style voting. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, the Golden Globes are gone, the Oscars are mired. So, what will happen to movies that are counting on award shows for free promotion? But next, is DRM finally OVER? 2007 was the worst 12-month period the music industry has ever seen. Sales of albums were down some 15% from 2006, continuing an 8-year slide. Digital downloads aren't even close to making up the difference, at least not legal downloads. Apple's iTunes is by far the download leader, though Amazon, Microsoft, and even Walmart have gotten into the act. Social networking sites like MySpace will soon follow, and music subscription services like Rhapsody are still hanging on. The thing that's kept the download business from really taking off is the boogeyman known as DRM, that is, Digital Rights Management. To copyright protect downloads or not copyright protect downloads? That is the question. Late last year, three of the big four labels, Universal, Warner's, and EMI, announced new copyright-free initiatives. Businessweek now reports that the last holdout, Sony BMG, has decided to sell some of their music DRM-free through Amazon's download service. But is it too little too late to save the music industry as we know it? Catherine Holohan wrote the story for Businessweek. She spoke with our producer, Matt Holzman.
Catherine Holohan, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Can you explain the thinking here? CDs don't have copyright protection. So why do the labels think that downloads need it? I mean, you certainly can buy a CD and rip the song and do all sorts of things with it. Why do downloads need protection any different from a CD?
Well, I guess the fear was that the music being pirated was being pirated online. So if there were no barriers between the music that you could download and then, you know, just putting it onto a peer-to-peer sharing site, a lot of people thought, well, why wouldn't people do that? Let's make it a little bit more difficult for that to happen. With the CD, you have to at least go through the step of uploading the music and putting it on your computer and then bringing it over to a file sharing site.
But basically, it's just one single step. So it does seem like the difference between the two should not be so great. It shouldn't be such a huge philosophical divide between the two.
Exactly. And I think that's certainly what the labels are finding out, is that really when they added this DRM protections to downloaded music, it didn't really curb piracy at all.
And in fact, it had the opposite effect in that it became punitive for people who did want to buy the music.
Yes.
Okay, so devil's advocate here. What is wrong with the record labels wanting to protect their product?
Well, I don't think anything's wrong with them wanting to protect their music. The problem is the way in which they're trying to protect it. I think that one alternative that's been offered is people saying that the label should just have watermarks, that basically things on the file that would let them know, okay, this is how the file is being used, and it's being, you know, it's being uploaded to a peer-to-peer site, or it's being used by one user on a variety of different devices. So that way they can kind of keep track of it, and if they notice, for example, a lot of things are getting uploaded to a certain peer-to-peer site, they can try and sue that peer-to-peer site and enforce their copyright protections with the actual people that are violating copyright law.
But you can't do that with a CD, and what continues to be kind of confusing to me is that why do they need to control this music when it's no different except for one simple step,
right,
than a CD? And they're killing themselves fighting essentially over that one simple step.
And I think there's some history that goes into it, is that the music industry was introduced in a way to downloadable music through seeing all of their music being pirated on these services. And so it kind of created a lot of distrust from the very beginning. And I think that sometimes the digital rights management and the policies towards that are an outgrowth of, you know, how they were affected by online music in the beginning.
You can't run a business being reactive, though. You just can't do it. It doesn't
work.
That's
true. And I think that's certainly something that we're seeing. That's why they're changing their ways.
Now, all the big four in the last couple of months have made some moves towards protection-free music. But are they experimenting with it, or are they embracing it? Are they committed to it?
The one who's embracing it the most is probably EMI.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually even offering DRM-free music through Apple iTunes. The others are in different stages. We've seen most recently Sony BMG say that it's going to offer DRM-free downloads via gift cards that people can purchase at Best Buy and Target. And so that's kind of tentatively moving into the DRM-free zone. The labels are trying to create a more vibrant market. And so they want to do this in a way where they can create some competition. Right now, Apple iTunes controls, some people say, 80% or more of the paid download market.
So to translate, a more vibrant market is to eliminate the stranglehold that iTunes has on the digital download market.
Exactly. And so that way they can have more negotiating power. Right now, because so much of the market is controlled by Apple, Apple can say, hey, we want to charge 99 cents per song. And the labels can say, well, actually, we'd rather have variable pricing. And they don't really have much bargaining power at the table. The more competition there is, the more they can say, actually, this is our preferred pricing.
But that seems so consistent with the mistakes that they continue to make, which is they want to be in control. When iTunes is doing a great job of creating a legal digital download market, now the record labels seem to be fighting them as well. Can they just not understand they need to just let go a little bit? I mean, it seems like in embracing digital rights-free music that they're starting to do that. But, I mean, it seems like maybe it's a little too late.
Well, certainly that's the fear, is that some people say, hey, Apple wouldn't have had all this power had you just offered DRM-free music to begin with, because then people could just buy music and put it on whatever player they owned, or if they were fans of the iPod, they could still get it from another service and put that music on the iPod, and that by saying, no, we have to have some sort of digital rights management on these tracks that control how users can use it after they purchase the music, it really forced people to say, okay, well, I like the iPod. I have an iPod, so therefore I have to use iTunes. I can't use another service because it's not easily compatible.
Last question for you. It seems like the labels and the potential distributors, other distributors, whether it be Microsoft or Apple or whoever, and then you have the consumers. But right. The one very big player in this kind of wild west of the music world right now is the courts, is that the court rulings seem to be injecting themselves and changing this kind of the path that music is taking for the future. Can you tell me something about some of the recent and pending lawsuits about music and downloading that may affect the future of what we see?
Well, I think as far as the lawsuits go, a lot of the lawsuits have been filed actually by the Recording Industry Association of America against people that are pirating music. But I think what really could change the industry are the antitrust rulings. You have, particularly in Europe, you have been looking very hard at how the DRM rules were marrying devices to particular download sites, and they've been saying, that really does create unfair monopolies, because if you're a fan of one store, you have to use the store's device in order to have everything work seamlessly.
Now, an individual in the United States, though, has brought a similar suit against Apple, and it seems like she may have a case.
Oh, sure. Well, her suit basically says, if I'm buying anything from iTunes, I should be able to use whatever device I want, and vice versa. If I'm buying it from another store, it should work seamlessly on my iPod. Right now, you can actually use the music that you buy on iTunes on other devices, but the way that you have to do it is often you buy the music, then you burn it to a CD, and then you re-upload it. And for a lot of consumers, that's too many steps. They feel, I bought this, it's mine, there shouldn't be any restrictions on how I use it. And we'll see how those play out, but I think that Apple really had taken some initiative there, and it said, if the music labels will get rid of DRM, we'd be happy to sell music without digital rights management. And certainly with its partnership with EMI, it's putting its money where its mouth is and offering those tracks for 99 cents that are without DRM. So in some respects, the suit is addressing a problem that Apple has already said, hey, we don't want DRM either. Talk to the labels.
Well, it's a tough time for the labels. It's a confusing time for consumers, but it seems like a great time for technology reporters. Catherine Holohan is one of them. She covers technology in the web for Business Week. Catherine, thanks for joining us on The Business.
Oh, thank you for having me.
A postscript. The hugely popular English alt-rock band Radiohead's new CD, In Rainbows, hit number one last week in its first week in stores. Not surprising, until you consider that the band offered downloads of this very music on a pay-what-you-want basis last October. Just more support for the idea that less control may actually mean more sales. In the past, we've talked about how important awards can be to selling certain movies. This year, unfortunately, we get to ask how the cancellation of the Golden Globes, and maybe even the Oscars, will affect movie marketing. We figured Walter Parks would be a good person to ask. He's produced two critically acclaimed movies out now, The Kite Runner and Sweeney Todd, both of which were counting on an awards push. After more than a decade as co-head of DreamWorks Pictures with his wife Laurie MacDonald, the two opened their own production company in 2005. Walter Parks, welcome to The Business.
Nice to be here.
So the Globes are canceled and the Oscars are in question. So how concerned are you about the prospects for your films, which are Sweeney Todd and The Kite Runner?
Well, I think in the case of both of those pictures, we're a bit damaged.
How so?
Well, there's certain movies for which the importance isn't so much the ceremony, but the award itself, movies that perhaps have already pretty much completed their domestic theatrical run. But there are other movies, and I'd say very much this is the case with Kite Runner, that were maybe, you know, made under stricter financial considerations that don't necessarily have enormous ad budgets. And in the actual planning for the movie, you're really counting on the exposure that one might get if you're lucky enough to be, you know, a part of an award show to really help the box office of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Even if the Oscars get canceled, I'd like you to explicate on this. What is the ultimate value of either a nomination or the award?
Certainly, if your film is in the marketplace and you're able to, both in 30-second spots and in newspaper ads, you know, highlight the fact that you are a nominee, it is a very important, you know, factor in getting people's attention. Again, you know, more and more in the last several years, the Oscars have been dominated not necessarily by studio fare or big budget fare, but rather, you know, critic pictures or pictures that in previous years would be seen as independent movies.
Yeah, no, and, I mean, in point of fact, I think two Oscars ago, four of the five Best Picture nominees were all independently financed movies.
Absolutely. The time of the big budget, you know, studio Oscar movie might be passed right now. I think the economics of the business mitigate against that. But as a result, there's all the more attention that's put upon the awards, partially because of the, you know, extraordinary escalating prices or costs of advertising time and the amount of noise that's out there. There's so much product on the in the marketplace that anything you can bring to bear that separates you from the pack is very, very, very important. And certainly being considered for the Best Picture Oscar or Golden Globe or winning it is, you know, enormously important.
Now, I cut you off earlier because you were starting to say something about The Kite Runner and in as a case in point, so to speak, of sort of a film that sort of its lifespan sort of hinges on award season. So talk a little bit about that. How is Kite Runner a case in point about this new paradigm?
Well, you know, we saying that it life's hinges on is maybe overstated, but it's certainly important. Listen, The Kite Runner is a movie of which we're all very proud. It's a movie, while it's based on a very successful book, it does not have big stars. And it's partially or you know, almost 50% in a foreign language. So it doesn't fit into a conventionally commercial category. It really is about the quality, the emotional experience you have, and the quality of the filmmaking itself. So therefore, to get people to notice it in this, you know, time where there's so many competing pictures that are vying for the audience's attention, you really want the kind of the seal of approval and just the kind of the mark of the nomination. Now, that really works in two ways. It's a tremendous help on your spots and on your advertising to be able to say two Golden Globe nominations or four Golden Globe nominations, whatever the case might be. It's also very important that you will have a three-hour period where your movie is being discussed in front of an enormously large television audience, because that television time is very, very expensive.
And you're talking about the telecast for the Golden Globes and for the Oscars.
Yes, the telecast itself. I mean, if we're lucky enough to win the Golden Globe for the foreign picture, we'll still be able to go and put that on our ads. We're going to have to buy those ads. It's a little bit different than having a kind of self-selective audience of moviegoers, which are the people who tend to watch the Golden Globes because they're interested in movies. They're captive, hearing about your movie in the context of these other terrific movies, you know, becoming more and more aware of the fact that it's out in the marketplace. I mean, honestly, we're timing the expansion, which means going into more theaters, to that telecast, which unfortunately now is no longer the case. Also, there's kind of a double value to it, because if you then, on top of it, choose to buy advertising during the award telecast, you have, again, a more captive, self-selective audience of people who are inherently interested in going to the movies.
After a short break, more with producer Walter Parks about how the cancellation of the Golden Globes, and maybe even the Oscars, may affect the movie business. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Walter Parks, along with his wife and partner, Laurie MacDonald, are the producers of two critically acclaimed movies in theaters now, The Kite Runner and Sweeney Todd. Neither is exactly killing at the box office, and both were counting on a push from exposure on awards telecasts. Alas, the writer's strike has caused the cancellation of the Golden Globes and may cause the Oscars to evaporate as well.
Now, you said that you were looking to those award shows to underscore the critical response to the movies and to sort of, push into expanded runs. Your use of the pluperfect there makes me ask the question, will you still? I mean, has the implosion of these award shows changed how you're going to release these movies?
As of right now, no. We're still looking at an expansion. The question of Sweeney's expansion, we had never decided whether or not we were going to expand. In fact, we originally had an 800-theater release plan, and it expanded based on the early word of mouth of the movie to 1,200. So we're pretty close to where we want to be with Sweeney anyway. But still, with the movie out there in 1,200 theaters, the award show was a very important thing for us, particularly the Golden Globes, because we're right in the heart of our run. To, remind people that it's not only the latest, fascinating movie by Tim Burton starring Johnny Depp, but it's specifically a highly critically regarded movie. And again, this is just one tool that's been taken away from us because of the award ceremonies going away.
Walter Parks is the producer of some of my favorite movies, including Gladiator, Minority Report, and Road to Perdition. And now in theaters, Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, and The Kite Runner. Walter, thanks for being on The Business.
My pleasure.
'Twas Pirelli's miracle elixir. That's what did the trick, sir. True, sir, true. Was it quick, sir? Did it in a tick, sir. Just like an elixir, all to do. How about a bottle, mister?
The Oxford Encyclopedic Dictionary defines swag as illicit gains or booty carried off by burglars. In Hollywood, swag, often pronounced schwag, is almost the exact opposite. It's crap, and I use that word carefully, that no one would dream of stealing. We're not talking about lavish gifts here, but the wave of promotional tchotchkes barfed out by the studios and the networks to promote their movies, TV shows, DVD releases, and anything else they can think of. The business producer Matt Holzman brings you this special investigative report we call Swag, Hollywood's Silent Scourge.
In Hollywood, swag can be a verb, as in, I got swagged. And nobody gets swag like the reporters at the show business newspaper of record, Variety. TV editor Joe Adalian manages to work from a cubicle area that is literally awash in mugs and mouse pads and logoed who knows what as far as the eye can see. This isn't holiday largesse or awards backsheesh, but the everyday state of affairs.
I have a 21 Jump Street locker that was Game Show Network. This is my Greed piggy bank. Whoa. There's Bender the Robot. Here's another thing from the 70s. It's a little Viewmaster. Prison Break. Hats are very popular. Well, it's from Shark Tale on DVD. You open it up, there's a whole unique sharkscape.
Reporters and reviewers get swagged. Media buyers get swagged. Affiliate stations and movie exhibitors get swagged. And then they're stuck with stuff that seems too nice to toss, but too cheap or too promotional to keep or re-gift. Mike Schneider is another TV editor at Variety.
Yeah, actually, I have containers of stuff at home because I don't know what to do with it. I don't want to get rid of it. It's not worth my time to give it to someone, or they wouldn't want it. But at the same time, I can't really sell it because then you enter the whole journalistic, questionable ethics of actually selling something. So it's kind of just collecting dust.
That swag is a big part of promotion is a fact of life in Hollywood. Why is more of a mystery? After all, what difference is a pair of so-you-think-you-can-dance padded insoles really going to make? But some swag stands out, and standing out in the sea of promotional material is the name of the game. In one case, the match game.
This right here is an ashtray from Game Show Network. It's a sort of very 70s, sort of yellow ambery, sort of smoked glassy thing that you would always see in the 70s with sort of the Match Game logo on it, the little GSN logo, and it certainly was very evocative. The Game Show Network, by the way, their swag historically has been clever.
Linnea Jimenez is vice president of creative services for the Game Show Network.
I know that TV critics get a ton of stuff every single day, and we want to make sure that our stuff, one, stands out, and two, when they see a box from GSN, that they want to open it.
The Match Game Ashtray was an unabashed swag hit, though swag's not always so successful.
We're trying to capture the essence in a tchotchke, which is really hard to do sometimes, especially when the show doesn't have as much personality as, let's say, a Match Game.
There's a lot of stuff out there that doesn't make you think about the program, but does make you ask yourself, what the hell were they thinking?
This came from We, Women's Entertainment. It was a green, very ugly lime green pail filled with random stuff. Now, there's some shortbread cookies, bottle of Jack Daniels, some Girl Meets Cowboy trail mix, some Twisted Sister F5 fruit twists, some Twinnings English afternoon.
On the other end of the spectrum, for instance, is the simple GSN game show buzzer that makes three sounds: wrong answer, right answer, and audience applause. All in all, GSN tries to keep the total cost of each item, including design, packaging, and mailing, to under $25.
Because it doesn't have to be expensive to be smart. For example, for the Match Game documentary, we could have spent tons of money, but this ashtray, what we thought might be Richard Dawson's ashtray as he smoked cigarettes show after show, and it was only, $2.50.
A major studio could spend in the hundreds of thousands of dollars on swag pushing a big film. Considering the number of studios, the amount of stuff that needs promotion per studio, and the increasing number of promotional outlets thanks in part to the web, well, that's just a lot of swag. Though some studios are now simply sending emails along with, say, a video link or an iTunes card, most swag is still the product of the more is better mentality. Consider what I got recently from Columbia Pictures promoting the John C. Reilly musical biopic send-up, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story.
Walk hard, hard.
The Cox Box, as it's labeled, is a big cardboard box, cleverly designed to look like a guitar amp, complete with reinforced metal corners and a handle. Inside, it's lined with faux red velvet and what appears to be a double LP cover, which actually contains a DVD and CD in one sleeve and a Dewey Cox World Tour t-shirt in the other. There's a signed glossy of Dewey Cox, what appears to be a cocktail napkin on which he scratched out the lyrics to the song Walk Hard, a Cox Rocks keychain complete with an enclosed guitar pick, an oversized brochure, and a big glossy calendar. The Cox Box is 4 pounds, 4.3 ounces of cardboard and plastic. That's just going in the trash, along with Hollywood's alleged conversion to eco-everything. News Corporation, for example, which owns Fox, has pledged to be carbon neutral by 2010, but you can bet they'll still be sending out mountains of swag. And you can see why. Because while we didn't do a segment about Walk Hard on this program, I am talking about it and playing the music. And that awareness is priceless. After all, as Joe Dalian of Variety points out, swag is all about getting your attention, not changing your mind.
I don't know a single journalist, though, who's ever written a positive story or a critic who's written a positive review because they got a fun lunchbox from The Simpsons.
To which Linnea Jimenez of GSN says,
I don't think that they're going to give us a good review. We just want them to take the DVD out of the case and put it in their DVD player. That's what we want them to do.
Buried somewhere in a mountain of blank, this is Matt Holzman for The Business.
To see the GSN buzzer and the Walk Hard Cox Box, check out our website at kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.